Okay, Lee. Well, this is always the hardest part for me, is to come to the end of anything like this, whether I'm attending it or emceeing it or whatever, because something just happens during the course of the week, mostly hanging around in here at the meals, sitting out at the benches, and they become the memorable times. And then when you travel around the country, you can look up each other, take somebody to your home group and show them around. And it's really nice. This talk is called Your Own Little World. And it's also just a collection of ideas that I call potpourri that I just lump in with that topic. And basically it goes, you've all been around when somebody, two women or two men are talking, and they're talking about somebody else, and then one of them says, well, you know her, she lives in her own little world. And it's generally meant in a derogatory way. Look at her, she lives in her own little world. Well, I would submit, so do you. And so do I. And so does everybody else. So much so that even if you've been married 30 years, you really don't know that other person's world anywhere near completely. You have a lot of ideas, but in terms of their view of themselves and their environment, it's definitely different. So if you carry that out and think about it, that means that on this planet, there's 6.7 billion little worlds. And somebody might make the case, yeah, okay, I see that. But in addition, there's the real world. And the response would be, maybe there is, maybe there isn't, but nobody lives there. That's a rather amazing thought, isn't it? Nobody really lives in what we call out here the real world. They live in their version of it. And there's somebody walking around here who thinks this place stinks today. Because when they open their eyes and looked around, they don't like what they see. And they don't realize that it's coming from their own mind. And they're projecting a filter over this place and find it oppressive. It's no wind. It's kind of, trees are closing in on you. All these birds walking around. God, God, God. River could overflow. God, God. That's not the world that you see. But something could happen, and you could come down and see that. So what I'm referring to in our literature is where Bill two or three times in the big book says, after all, our problems are of our own making. And following that to its conclusion, our world is of our own making, because that's what constitutes the world. Clancy calls it a disease of perception. Well, perception is all there is. There's nothing besides your perception of what's going on. There's not, and then what's really going on? Well, then, all right, well, then you say there's your perception of what's going on, and there's what's really going on. Well, what exactly is that? My perception of what's going on? Three college professors' perception? So we suddenly are left with the fact that we create our own reality, whether we can believe that or not. And that's where we live. We live in that world. And drinking took us out of that world. That's why we liked it so much. Whew, this is more like it. We got a vision of something different. It had the power to cause us to see things differently, and we liked it. Now, this is more like it. Well, what are we comparing it to? What is like it? You know that sentence? It's more like it. I think I would say, going back to Natcher, Dr. Natcher and Dr. Young, that's our recollection of our real home. This is more like it. In other words, what is it? Where do we even come up with it? And it was such a inspiring scene after several drinks. You could have said, this is heavenly. You know what I mean? As you sat on the bar stool. This is heaven. We could have said those words. And we would be getting close. We would be getting close to coming home. And that, again, is what Dr. Natcher was talking about. That there's something inside of us that remembers home. I'm using that as a way of saying remembers God, our true selves, whatever you want to call it, the truth. And without realizing it, that's what we're trying to find as we walk around in this not so friendly world of our own making. And that's the part that we can't, it's very difficult for us to believe that this thing was made by us. So what is a world made out of? Well, it's only one building material, thought. It's composed entirely of thoughts. And that's what we do. What do you do with anything? I got to go think about that. I got to think some more. Let me think some more. So we're generating building material. We're going home and putting a fence in. I'm going to think about that. And I'm not going to see that person anymore. And I'm going to isolate. And then I build a fence. And I move away from them or towards them or whatever it is. And so just to use that as a starting point, I put it together a bunch of stories that fit in that general category as a starting place. That we're trying to solve the dilemma of living in our own little world. And it also ties in old ideas availed us nothing. The old ideas being our own little world. And the steps smash our world so that we can go home. Or it will be revealed, and then as we see a glimpse of the kingdom, our hearts get pretty excited because we go, how could I have forgotten this? How could I? Oh, my God, I can't believe I forgot who I really am, what the real deal is, and I got out here in this strange place. Another way out of this little world is humility. And humility has it has a bizarre time of it in AA. Somewhere back in the beginning, someone said that if you say you're humble, you're not. So you got to. It's almost like you're almost afraid to include humble in a sentence for fear someone will call a technical violation on you for even using the word. Were you even thinking about humble? He's not humble at all. He was thinking the word humble over there. It's okay to read it in the seventh step. Humbly, I'm reading. I'm not actually claiming to have any humility at all. And so when I was out in California, I tried to talk a little bit on that, and I said that I was there to praise humility and not to bury it. I was trying to bring it out where we can freely see what an integral part of our whole sobriety it is. Every time you say you're an alcoholic, you're making a very humble statement. What does the sentence mean? It means I have a situation that I can't handle on my own, and I desperately need help, mostly spiritual help. That's the statement that we're making when we say, I'm an alcoholic. In a church, they would say, I'm a sinner. Now, we're very turned off by that word. They mean the same thing. They mean being too far away from God. And that's where we were. And what does our steps do? Takes us from too far away from God to contact with God. So there's a tremendously humble statement. What other humble things do we do? Read the big book. Why are we reading the big book? For help. For help, because I can't manage it on my own. Call my sponsor. Go to meetings. Make coffee. I mean, when you start down the list, every activity, sponsor someone. Everything we do in AA is an act of humility. And we're afraid to recognize it. But we have to recognize it to see that this is our only ticket out of pride. I call it our passport. We've been given a passport to leave the country of pride. Pride, the country of pride is a dark, lonely, the four horsemen. I mean, we've got some wonderful terms in our AA literature. Incomprehensible, demoralized. That's, every time I read that, I go, Bill, you nailed it with that one. Incomprehensible demoralization. How do you get out of there? We're stuck in there. Humility. You walk up to the gatekeeper and you go, here's my passport. Humility. The reason that is, it's humility is a total absence of pride. Humility is an acknowledgement that I can't do anything on my own, and I'm going to turn to God. And as I make that, so in the church we might say, I don't know why I'm drawing parallels, we might walk up to the devil with the crucifix and go, yeah! And that would be our passport through the danger. You follow what I'm saying? So humility is the only way out. As long as we defiantly say we don't need help getting out of our own little world, we'll stay there forever. And that's why when we get a little bit of help and we see that it works, it becomes even harder to ask for the rest of the help, because we know we're going to be taken totally out of there by God. And there won't be a remnant of that place that we so diligently built over a period of 50 years or however long it is. So part of us, even though it's a lousy world, there's a great deal of pride of authorship. I thought up this crappy place that I live, and I just don't feel like leaving it because it's mine. You know what I'm saying? It's like sitting in jail going, I got myself here. I'm not in here by accident like some of those guys. I thought the stick up all on my own. So I want full credit for being in here. And that's where we are. We're in our own jail, whatever it looks like. It could be just one corner of your room where you go to be in your own little world. Just want to see, there's a big difference between silently reflecting, which is done all by ourselves, and loneliness. There's a huge difference. And our specialty, everybody in this room, I'm sure, is loneliness. That's where I live, in my own little world. So humility really is a marvelous thing. It's what enables us to work on character defects. It's what enables us to pick up the telephone to call our sponsor. That's the only thing that'll allow us to pick it up. There isn't another part of us that will let us pick it up. We could be suffering. We could desperately need help. And guess who's standing at the door evaluating whether we're going to get the call for help? Pride. What's the matter? I'm suffocating. Suffocate a little longer, and then maybe we'll let you make a phone call. I've got to make really sure it's an emergency, because you let somebody in to help, they're liable to keep helping. And keep helping, and I won't be in charge anymore. I won't be the jailer. I won't be the custodian of you in your own little world. And so I was when I went to California, Clarita, Santa Clarita. And they had a convention up there, and my son is the head of the drama department at Redlands University out there. And my granddaughter, Zoe, plays the violin, and they've already got her in plays. I mean, her mother's a poet. And so she is just very artistic and loves all that. So every time I go out and she comes to the conference, I prepare a story for my granddaughter. But the story is really about AA, and I tell her it's a story for her about God. And a couple years ago, I had a story about God's hair. But this story, since it's about a theater, and I've used the analogy before, but it works better with the theater. When you go to a theater, one of the things that's there and is quite visually present, as a matter of fact, we have them in this room, they're exit doors, and they have that sign right there. And it's quite, and we're so used to it that may be the first time that you actually put your attention on that. But it's been here the whole time. There's four of them. And I tell Zoe that everybody has an exit door. But they forget that they have an exit door. And even though the light is shining, they don't even see it. It's kind of like when you go into a movie and you're looking at everything. And there's an exit door right there. But when the movie starts, there isn't a chance in hell that if we turned out the light in the exit door, you'd miss it. That exit door is not part of the movie. It doesn't exist, but it's there. And so I tell it, we all have an exit door. And if we could stay aware of that door at all times, we would always remember that we're in a theater. But if you don't, sometimes the movie is so real, you almost have a heart attack. You get so involved in it. Maybe your favorite movie actress is starring in this, and you're at an opening night, and you have tickets to backstage. And unfortunately, the movie is about her getting a dreadful disease which slowly kills her, culminating in a beautiful Hollywood death scene at the end as she tearfully utters her last words with great lighting and music, and you're reduced to tears. I'm so, oh God, oh God, oh God. And you're still crying as they take you backstage. Oh God, oh God. And you're still crying as you're getting the autograph. And she asks her, "Why are you crying?" "Because you died." I'm signing the book. I'm right here. It was a movie. Oh, but it seemed so real. It seemed so real. Well, if you'd glance over at the exit door once in a while, you could keep it in perspective. And I tell Zoe, there's going to come a day when the door's blinking. It's really going to get your attention. And you're actually going to go over and go through the exit door. And as soon as you open it, you're going to go, oh my God, there's the light. Oh, there it is. How could I have forgotten this? Oh my God. And you walk in and you're just filled. Oh, yes, of course. Wow. Wow. And then you reach up and there's God's hand, just like it's always been for billions of years. And he says, did you enjoy the show? And you go, what show? Did you enjoy the show? Do you remember when I dropped you off? Turn around. And on the other side of the exit door, it says, theater entrance. Theater entrance. A lot of these theater entrances are in maternity wards. Theater entrance. And I told you that this show is quite spectacular. Matter of fact, let's go back in and let me just show you what you were just attending. So they come back through the door and God holds Zoe and says, do you see what this is? Do you know how long it took me to build this stage? Have you ever seen a stage like this? Look at this mountains, 27,000 feet high. That took some doing. Look at this, the desert. Look at this, 50 kinds of animals. I mean, this is an amazing creation I got here. Watch this, lightning, boom, thunder, boom, tidal wave, meow. Look at that, I got 1,000 people whew, out the exit door. Right out the exit door. Isn't that amazing? Look at that. Look at that. This is theater in the round. It's the ultimate show. This is the greatest show on earth. The greatest show on earth is earth. And that's what God was showing Zoe. And he said, so, I'm going to send you back in. Let you watch the show again. And just remember the exit door. Try to have conscious contact with that door throughout the whole show. And you'll always know that it's a show. And when it's over, I'll be waiting. Are there any questions? And that was my little story to tell her about God. And if you can feel it, so that's what conscious contact feels like. I'm in touch with God, the reality, as I watch this show. So I don't have to take it seriously. I don't have to worry about it. It's all going to unfold. And I will always have it in perspective. My perception will be accurate as long as I can be aware of that sign right there, that that's where I am. Another part of it is, if 10 people see an accident, and then you go take an accident report from each of them, you really think you've got reports about different accidents. Oh, no, no, the lady was slowing down. That other guy deliberately sped up to hit her. And this one over here and this one over here. So each of them had what I call their own version of what happened. And I submit to you, that's the most important thing that we listen to, is our own version of what happened. And there's an old story that illustrates how powerful your own version is. And it's the three umpires arguing over who's the best umpire. And the first umpire says, I call them as I see them. And the second umpire said, I call them as they are. And the third umpire says, until I call them, they aren't. And so, do you realize how important our version is? And our version happens instantly with everything. That's a version of how that, and it's very nice. Everywhere I go, what am I doing? I'm not just observing it, I'm judging it. Judge, 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 judge. You follow what I'm saying? Wonderful meal except for. And so our version is made out of, instead of just regular thoughts, our version is made out of concrete thoughts. We don't back off from our version very often. And so here we have a lot of concrete in our world. And we come, and when we go to dismantle it through the 12 steps, there's places that really are resisting the idea that it could be wrong. I mean, yeah, I could see, okay, I made a little mistake. Yeah, that was the wrong way to drive. Yeah. Oh, no. No. That war is wrong. Whatever one you put in concrete. No, I don't even want, that's not open for any reconsideration. How many of those do you think we have in our little arsenal of the world we built? And they all got to come down. They all have to be smashed, or we're stuck in that world. The other story, it's a very brief one, but all of these are designed to make a point about what we're trying to solve, what we're trying to work on in here. We all know what we're doing. We all know what the steps are, what prayer, what meditation. This is just, by portraying it with various stories, I think it motivates us to try even harder. And go, my God, you actually could smash out of there. I could smash out of there. Now I see what the heck I'm trying to do. I'm trying to smash out of my own world. If, for example purposes, your entire... that was a solid wall over there and went all the way like that. And it was a mural of your life up to this point. And it was painted, and those great big time type things. There you are, you're a baby, now you're in grammar school, and there you are. Oh, you're flying an airplane, now you got married. Oh, all along there. And it's in beautiful color. It's absolutely amazing. And that actually is how everybody's life was. That's when you saw somebody's life, that's what you saw. And we asked the question, what role did you play in creating that mural? I think we'd be quite chagrined to find out that we played the role of the brush. The picture was painted by the master through us on the great scenery. Well, that doesn't make me much of a... And then you go, I'm in charge of my life. I'm the guy. No, you're in charge of the phony stuff, the reaction to things. And if you think you're in charge, then ask yourself this question. What could you have done to have gotten to AA 2 years sooner? Let's go back to your alcoholism and go, now if you're lucky, you go, Nothing. I had to hit my bottom. There's nothing I could have done to get to AA 2 years sooner. Can you imagine something you could have done with what you have to have gotten here 2 years sooner? I ended up saying, nope, it had to happen the way it happened. I had to get there. And I said, okay, well, that's the powerful disease of alcoholism, so let's use something else. Could I have gotten higher grades in college? And I've really tried to get myself higher grades because I barely passed. And I look back on me at that time, and I concluded, no. Could I have avoided that stupid relationship in high school? No. And it became very uncomfortable to realize that I couldn't have done anything differently. And that was the first time I had a hint that I don't have much control over anything, and that my life story is being told by something else other than me. God has a plan. We say it all the time. But when we actually feel it, we go, but I help him. See, I want to play an important role in God's plan. Well, when did you decide 5 years ago to be in charge of all the AA meetings in the local prison? When did you put that plan into effect? Or did it in fact just happen? Did not your sponsor say, come on, I want you to help me with this? And then you helped them for a couple years, and then he said, now you do it. Now, see, here's why we get faked out in AA. Because when that person a few years later gives his talk, he says, then I decided to get involved in prison work. There's a lot of talks like that in AA, where we just don't like to not be in charge of anything. And so we just slightly modify the actual description of what took place. Now, as I struggled with this, I realized that my ego was my arch enemy. I don't know how he got cast into the role of arch enemy. You gotta kill that ego. He's out to get me. He's just a terrible guy. And I got thinking about, wait a minute, that's part of me. That's part of me. I don't want to be hating part of me. And Chris has heard me talk about this, so I finally figured out who my ego is. Have you figured out who? I have a name. I have an actual name for my ego. My ego's name is Frank Morgan. Now, you may not remember who that is. Frank Morgan is the actor who played the wizard in The Wizard of Oz. And he somehow got the job of getting behind that screen and scaring the crap out of everybody. Well, there's going to be a wicked witch coming after you. That girl hates you. You're no good. Watch out, little boy. I'm going to get you. And then Dorothy came up, pulled the screen away, and the wizard was glad to get out of the job. He was some kind of a businessman from somewhere else. And he really wanted to go back home. He doesn't even really remember why he got the assignment of going back there going, ooh. So somewhere way back, when I was real little, part of me took great delight in scaring me. And I liked it because it made life much more exciting. My earliest recollection up in Connecticut, with 6 years old or something, coming home from grammar school by a swampy area, there was a log in there by some remote description could be meant for an alligator in Connecticut. And I went, was that an alligator? You follow what I'm saying? And then I looked over and Frank Morgan said, "Yes, you better go home and hide. It could get you." And I went home, and I'll be damned, I stayed up all night. I kept hearing an alligator. There was a rustle outside. Another gator. A gator could be in the closet. A gator. And part of me was terrified. Part of me thought it was exciting. Up until that moment, I was just in a little bed, going to bed. Now I'm in there with an alligator in the closet that could be coming after me. And so that part, the little creator of things that aren't real, got his start. And he got really good at it, and I got good at believing him. And now I just want to tell him the game's over, that we're buddies again, that I understand, no hard feelings. Let's pull the screen down, go have a cup of coffee. So this way, we could have a friendly relationship with our ego. And so I thought up a poem to describe this. A lot of us like to play hide and seek, especially when we were young. I thought it was the coolest game in the world. Although if you hid in a really hard place, I'd stop seeking. This isn't that much fun. But hide and seek. So there's nobody to play hide and seek with, so you play by yourself. That's a tough thing to do, isn't it? So here's how I imagine that I did it. "Where shall I hide," I said, "where I will never find me? I know, I'll pretend that I'm not me, nor you, nor he. I'll hide in a story and pretend that it's real. I'll believe what I think and feel what I believe. And I'll lie trapped in a web of those feelings, having forgotten I'm the creator of the web. Oh my God, I can't find me." That's where I think we are. Oh my God. I don't know where I am anymore. I don't know where the guy who started this game is. I'm the game. And I can't even remember how to unwind the freaking game so I can go back to just being me. And so that's my little hide and seek. I can feel it. I can feel myself thinking thoughts and having the feelings associated with them. Look at that guy. He's out to get my girl. He hasn't done anything. He just sat there. And now I'm trapped in another feeling. It's a scary place to be until you realize it's a joke. Sorry, it's a joke. I'm like the three-card Monty guy in New York City. Hey, watch this. Here's the ace, the king, and the ten. Boom, 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 boom. And you never get it right. Gone. God damn. How does he do that? How does he do that? Well, we can understand how this guy could do it to us, but how do we play both roles? I run around over here, bump, 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 and then I run back, and I guess it wrong. I'm the guy who put it there. I've gotten so good, I can move him and then run around and be faked out. That's pretty clever stuff. Now, my serious part goes, I'm not that dumb. It's not that simple. You know how we hate simple things? It's not that simple. It's not that simple. And then we go, what did Bill call our program? An utter simplicity. It is that simple. It is that simple. I might have even cried in the middle of that poem when I said, oh my God, I've lost me. You remember what you yelled when they tried to get the game over? Ollie, Ollie, and free. I probably cried that a lot of times, and nobody came. That was a sad game. That's why we're all so sad. We've lost ourselves. AA has been called the world's largest lost and found department. And you can look at the disease of alcoholism as being lost. And you look at AA as home. All of us have that feeling. When we came here, I felt home. Everybody is home. So we must have a tremendous longing to go home. That's where I want to go. But Frank Morgan screwed the map up. And he sent me over here, over there, over here, over there. It's right up there. Right up Cocaine Alley. Right up Budweiser Street. Right down Vodka Boulevard. There's home. It's right there. And it felt like we were going home. You remember that? Yeah, I'm getting close, getting close. Whoops, the nut ward. Like that Monopoly game. Go directly to jail. If we had an alcoholic Monopoly game, every card would say, go directly to jail. Do not pass go. Bam. Let's keep making stories up about the same plot. So we'll get Hollywood involved this time. Just to show you how powerful and tricky it is. Now, this is going to be a real stretch, okay? But some of those Hollywood plots are a big stretch. Okay, in this movie, your best friend falls asleep and has chronic nightmares and cannot be woken up. And so the first 20 minutes in the movie is, oh, and he's just going crazy with these terrible nightmares. And their hypnotism, their injection, they're doing all these things, and nobody can solve the problem of him having these, dreaming up these nightmares. And they come to you and they say, you're his best friend, right? You know him better than anyone. Yes. Do you think if you could talk to him, you could talk him through this? Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, and here's the stretch of the imagination. We found a way of reducing you to an injection. And we can inject you into his brain and into his dream so that you can walk right up and talk to him in the middle of the dream. It's perfectly safe, wink, wink, because we can pull you out anytime we want. One of these science fiction things. But anyway, you're now there. And there's your best friend screaming. And you go up to him and you go, Frank, it's me. It's Steve. Steve, how you doing, pal? You're dreaming. This is all a dream that you're having. I can get you out of here. Do you understand? It's not a dream to me. This is real, man. I mean, don't tell me this is a dream. And the struggle goes on as you try to convince him that it's a dream. And the question is, how do you? And you suddenly realize you can't. What are you going to tell him that this is a dream? What if somebody walked in here and said, none of this is real. There is no Dave Springs. There's no other people in this room. That would be a hard sell, wouldn't it? You have to wake up. Then you'll see what's real. So it gives a sense of how difficult it is to believe that all of our ideas have to be smashed if we want to see what's real. And so I remember thinking about that, and I decided there wasn't any way to do it. I came up with self-centered trance. I think another description would be spiritual amnesia. I just can't remember, but I know it's inside of me somewhere is the true nature of my spirituality. And so the final question gets down to, in the middle of all this, hide and seek. And I try to come up with the question of, who am I? And again, a very amateurish poem. I am the yin, I am the yang, and everything in between. I am the up and I am the down. I am the hide and I am the seek. I am the in and am the out. I am the black and am the white. I am the life and I am the death. But most of all, I am. So it gets reduced down, like all simplicities, to a two-word sentence. I am. Period. And I simply reflect on that sentence. What does that sentence say? And if you sit and think about that a while, that's a hard sentence to look at. And simply stay in the I am. And the flip side is that the solution to the whole program is let go. See what I'm saying? It is an utter simplicity which encases a complete mystery. So now we've come to the end of the line. An utter simplicity which encases a complete mystery. Now I said that when Bill wrote the 12 and 12 in step 7, that he mentioned a particularly important moment. And that great moment was when we sought humility as something we wanted instead of something we needed. That became a huge turning point in anyone's life. So I would submit to you the same thing happens with respect to the great mystery. There's no way to describe God and the universe other than the great mystery. It is the ultimate mystery. What do smart, intellectual human beings do when confronted with a mystery? Solve it. I'm going to figure it out. Bill writes all the way back in the 30s. Men of science are forcing nature to disclose her secrets. And I'm sure back then they went, and in about 10 more years, we'll have them all. Well, 10 more years, and they went, whoa, we got them all, but now I don't know what this thing is. What the hell is this? And we're close. Listen to them now. We got this thing. We got one more thing. One more super collider over there. Once we go there, all of God's secrets will be known. And we all know that they're going to go, uh-oh, what's that? What is that that we just found? So it's going to be an unending mystery of great magnitude, such as God is. So a great moment, similar to the one in humility, comes when we stop trying to figure out the mystery and behold it. Reflect on it. Enjoy it. Look at it with great wonder. That's where the word wonderful comes from. Full of wonder. And you can't go past that. When can we put down the desire to understand and figure out and simply look at everything with great awe and wonder? And we got a way of wrapping this up to capture that theme, and then we'll be all done. Okay, Lee.
I see some green, red roses too. I see them blue. for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, bright blessed days, dark sacred nights, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the skies, also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry, I watch them grow, they'll learn much more than I'll ever know, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world, yeah. I think to myself.